Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and here are just some of the voices you'll be hearing on today's show. Writer Paul Ford on a surprising Japanese import.
There is something so powerful about this song, and it just repeatedly gets weaponized.
Our listener Carrie on her surprising reaction to a very popular band.
I have to say, I kind of want to punch all of them in the face.
And because it can't all be about weapons and fisticuffs, musician John Hopkins on his surprising percussion instrument.
So the left pedal is kind of broken over the years. I've had the same piano since I was about 8 years old. And every time the tuner comes, he offers to fix the pedal. But I love that creaking sound so much. So I thought I'd actually build a track around it instead of getting rid of it.
John Hopkins plays live electronic dance music and live piano for us later on Soundcheck, and we'll get to the bottom of that weaponized song and punch-provoking band that Paul and Carrie were talking about. But first, let's talk about ticket prices for big concerts, big shows, big sporting events, whatever. Ticket prices are just too low. Yeah, that got your attention, didn't it? Well, good, because Adam Davidson, co-founder and co-host of NPR's Planet Money, wants to shine a light on a dark corner of the concert world, ticket scalping. He wrote a recent article about it for the New York Times, which you can read on our website, soundcheck.org, and he's come to some surprising conclusions. Adam Davidson, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks so much.
So your article takes place outside of a Tom Petty concert. Did you go as a fan or were you working?
Purely working. Yeah, I never got in to see the show.
Well, and part of the reason for that is that tickets were pretty scarce. You know, he was playing a smaller theater than he could usually sell out.
Yeah, I mean, here's a guy who could sell out Madison Square Garden. He's playing at the much smaller Beacon Theater, owned by Madison Square Garden. But, you know, he likes that intimate setting, but it means there's huge demand and very little supply.
Right. And so there are people outside scalping tickets. And one of the big surprises in your article is when you come to the conclusion that people are scalping tickets because Tom Petty is underpricing his concert. Now, anybody who's been to a concert recently, I mean a big concert, is likely to walk away from your article thinking, what is wrong with Adam Davidson? So let me ask you, what is wrong with Adam Davidson?
What's wrong with Adam Davidson is that I study too much economics. So I grew up here in New York City. I used to go to concerts at Madison Square Garden when $17 was a big price to pay for a concert. And so I do know that when you get that, I mean, tickets at the Tom Petty concert were going upwards of $100, $150.
Right.
And my understanding is you could get, you know, real front row seats for, you know, far, far more than that. But in an economic context, there's no such thing as the right price or the fair price. Economists don't really talk that way. It's just where does supply meet demand. So by definition, if the price that they're being sold at is such that someone can buy it at that price and sell it for much more to someone else, then it is below the price where supply meets demand. It's underpriced. It's a real puzzle for economists because it's hard to think of any other market where you go to buy something and there's an entire subsidiary industry entirely based around profiting from the mismatch in between supply and demand.
So we don't have ticket scalpers for, I don't know, doctor's appointments.
Right. Doctor's appointments, iPhones. You don't go to like a great restaurant and someone's out front saying, hey, I'll give you this steak for $87. And I know it's 32 inside, but I'll give you this steak. And one of the questions economists have is, are the artists profit maximizing? I mean, literally, I talked to this one economist, Pascal Corti in Canada, who I was asking him, so is Tom Petty, is Bruce Springsteen, are they just good guys? They just like their fans? Or are they profit maximizing in a different way? And there's a reason to think they are being clever financially as well as clever with fan loyalty.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take the Springsteen example. You know, he's made a lot of noise about keeping ticket prices low, and you know, he's not the only one. But in your article, you suggest that that can be seen as a very savvy way of actually making more money off the backs of these people.
Absolutely. So if you think of a Bruce Springsteen, Tom Petty, someone who expects to have fans for decades, I mean, they're making a lifelong career out of this. And people do know, I mean, you know this, that when someone has seen a band live, they're just more invested in that band, probably for the rest of their life. They're more likely to buy their albums. They're more likely to buy other tchotchkes, buy the T-shirts, buy the key ring. So one theory is that someone like Bruce Springsteen, someone like Tom Petty, as opposed to someone like the Rolling Stones, Paul McCartney, Barbara Streisand, who are really charging a fortune, the kind of fan-friendly strategy is to stretch that fandom out over a longer period of time. In the day we sweated out on the streets of a runaway American dream. At night we racked the mansions of glory and suicide machines. Sprung from cages on Highway 9, chrome wheel, fuel injected, and stepping out over the line. Oh, maybe this town rips the bones from your back. It's a death trap. It's a suicide rap. We gotta get out while we're young. Cause tramps like us, baby, we were born to run.
That's a little bit of Bruce Springsteen, an artist known for keeping ticket prices low. I'm speaking with Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money about his recent New York Times piece on ticket scalping. You can find a link on our website, soundcheck.org. So, Adam, Bruce Springsteen's not the only artist who's known for this type of affordable ticket pricing. There's another artist who's really risen to the forefront of this movement, right?
Yeah. I had a really fun conversation with Kid Rock in writing this, and he said, you know, I don't have a hit album out right now, and I've just decided I want to maximize the number of people who see me. And so I just locked in $20, and I just filled bigger and bigger venues. And I'm having a hit concert. I'm going to make a lot more money, maybe not per ticket, but overall than if I had maximized the per ticket price. And those people are going to be my fans for years.
Right. On the other hand, Kid Rock is also admittedly scalping his own tickets for some of the what they call the platinum seats, the ones that are not $20, where he buys a block and then just sells them on the secondary market for as much money as he can get.
Yes, and that's a big thing that Ticketmaster is pushing. They're asking artists to do this because what they've discovered is, you know, when you go to a show and there's scalpers out front, when there's 12 or 20 guys out front saying, hey, tickets, tickets, the bulk of that business is the first 10 rows or so. It's those premium seats. And especially when an artist like Bruce Springsteen or someone sells all the orchestra seats all for the same price, one thing economists notice is scalpers are really just a mechanism for sorting the high-value seats to the right people. So the idea is if you get that premium price for those first 10 rows, say, then you've knocked out a stool in the scalper's arsenal.
Well, on Kid Rock's $20 Best Night Ever summer tour, most tickets do in fact cost $20, but there are these 1,000 platinum tickets priced between $60 and $350. This is some of the music that you would see for your $20 to $350.
It was 1989, my thoughts were short, my hair was long. Caught somewhere between a boy and man. She was 17 and she was far from in between. It was summertime in northern Michigan.
We're talking with Planet Money host Adam Davidson about his recent article about ticket scalping in the New York Times. And Adam, let me just come back to something you were just talking about. So explain how Kid Rock scalping his own expensive seats cuts down on scalping for all of the seats to his event.
Right. So if Kid Rock sold all seats for $20, what you would expect is scalpers would grab as many of those as they can, and they have these complicated computer programs where they can automatically kind of game the Ticketmaster website on the moment the tickets are released, and they end up grabbing a lot of them. And basically what they'd be doing is buying hundreds and hundreds of tickets, knowing that they might sell the back rows at a loss, but trying to gobble up those front 10 rows or whatever it is. So if he takes those front 10 rows off the market, that really reduces the incentive for the scalpers to even buy tickets in the first place.
So are the people buying the tickets that aware of what row they're buying in? Don't they just want to get into the show by any means?
Well, that's the thing. It's an unfair competition because you have fans who just want to get into the show, but then you have these scalpers who want those front row seats, and the scalpers are the ones who bring a lot of technology to the table.
All right. Speaking of technology, you know, in the old days, scalpers bought tickets like the rest of us and then stood outside and sold it for as much money as they can. Now, as you were just saying, they've got these sophisticated computer programs. As soon as tickets go on sale, they're slamming Ticketmaster. They're buying in bulk all the good seats. It seems like this would be a scalper's dream. And yet in your article, one of the guys is complaining that his business is, you know, like half of what it once was.
Yeah, I talked to this guy, short, bald guy, who's been scalping as his main professions for over 20 years, 23 years. And he said in the 80s and 90s, he was bringing in 70 grand a year, which is pretty good if all you're doing is scalping tickets. He says he's lucky to bring in 30 grand now, and he's older, you know.
Yeah.
He says some of the other scalpers are supporting their kids on this. This is the only business they know. I'd say most of the scalpers I saw that night were middle-aged or even older people. So these were career scalpers. But they just can't compete with StubHub and some of the other electronic secondary markets, which are very much used by more sophisticated scalpers, people who have the computer savvy, you know. These are guys who've been standing in front of concert halls and sports venues for 23 years. These are not the computer savvy guys. So they're really picking up now the dregs. I mean, right now, if you're going to Tom Petty show, you know, you go to StubHub. You don't go to the concert venue and buy tickets. Also, if you go to the concert venue to buy tickets, now, I learned a trick. The scalpers right in front of the concert venue, really openly doing it in front of the cops, those guys are probably legitimate, but the guy's two blocks away. There's a good chance they're going to sell you a fake ticket that looks right, and then they're going to be gone when you get kicked out of the venue when you try to use those tickets. So it's taking on a lot of risk to go down to the venue.
Okay. So StubHub has changed the experience for the scalpers and I guess for ticket buyers, because it gives you kind of a safer way to scalp tickets.
Yeah, it's less sketchy. You feel like you have a guarantee. The other thing, interestingly, is it's changed the politics of this because, you know, scalping was illegal. I actually spent a very brief period of time scalping illegally when I was in high school in the mid-80s in New York, and I got stopped by a cop, and it was very scary, and I never did it again. But Elliot Spitzer effectively legalized it about 5-6 years ago, and part of the political thing there is it used to be the concert promoters and the like wanted scalping illegal, and there wasn't a powerful, legitimate voice on the other side. But now you have StubHub, owned by eBay. They can afford lobbyists. They can afford the kind of pressure that allows scalping to be legalized. But they benefit, of course, not the street-level guys.
Right. So we're talking with Adam Davidson about ticket scalping. You can read his article recently for the New York Times on our website at soundcheck.org. Adam is host of Planet Money, co-host and co-founder of that production of NPR and This American Life. Ticket scalping seems like, you know, in some instances in the sports world, in the concert world, on Broadway, you know, kind of the bane of the average fan's existence. There are ways around it. And I remember at the last World Cup, the Soccer World Cup, one of the things that they did was to kind of create these computer-coded tickets that, you know, you had to show ID that you were the person who bought that ticket. Now we have the idea of paperless tickets, which also is like you're the only one who can use that ticket. Is that a solution?
It seems to be a solution, but not the solution. New York happens to be the one state that has outlawed paperless tickets for reasons.
Why?
I don't understand. It's a very weird a very weird side effect. But yes, this is more and more the case. Kid Rock is using it.
Paperless tickets.
Paperless tickets. Now, you can't do it for everyone. I mean, just think of the hassle of, you know, having an usher just rip tickets versus having an usher check your ID, scan your ticket. I mean, it's like suddenly turning every concert hall into the worst airport security line. So right now, it's around 0.1% of tickets are paperless tickets. And even the biggest deployment of them would be only the best seats in the house kind of thing. Ticketmaster does not foresee a world in which most tickets are like that. But that's another way. Now, that does have a downside. I mean, it means there was not scalping, but it also means if you catch a cold or you got to go out of town and you want to give your best friend, you know, a nice night at Tom Petty, you can't do it. You can't.
You just got to eat the cost of that ticket. And if it is, as you say, the most expensive seats, that could be a substantial amount of money.
Yeah, exactly.
A problem with many possible solutions, none of which seem to be, as you say, the solution just yet. Adam Davidson, the co-founder and co-host of Planet Money. Nice talking with you.
Great talking to you, too.
I know that time has numbered my days, and I'll go along with everything you say. But I ride home laughing, look at me now, to the walls of my town, they come crumbling. In a call of my unborn sons, and I know that choices color all I've done. But I'll explain it all to the watchman's son. I ain't ever lived a year better spent in love. Cause I know my weakness, know my voice, and I'll believe in grace and choice.
A little bit of Mumford & Sons, another band that will be adopting paperless ticketing for at least some of its concert seats on their summer tour. Coming up, another installment of our series, That Was a Hit. This time, a Japanese song that topped the American charts in 1963 and just won't go away. But first, we'll hear from some of you. This is Soundcheck.
Takes me too much time. You should know me better than that.
I'm John Schaefer. Last week on Soundcheck, I talked with the music critic Carl Wilson about his recent piece for Slate.com called simply Why I Hate the National, a harsh but thoughtful meditation on this Brooklyn-based band, which just released their new album, Trouble Will Find Me, which, for the record, is a great album, and Carl Wilson is totally wrong. You can hear the conversation for yourself on soundcheck.org. Now, after that, I asked you to tell us about a band you think you're supposed to like, a band that seems maybe tailor-made for you, but which you just can't stand. Well, here's Carrie from Astoria.
The band that I know I'm supposed to like as an educated professional in New York City is Vampire Weekend, and I have to say, I kind of want to punch all of them in the face. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Matt from Sunnyside. I know a lot of people like Tom Waits, and he's really good, and he's been around for a long time, but I just can't do it. Yeah, I don't know. I just can't listen to all those sad songs for so long.
Oh, you've got to hold on, hold on. Baby, gotta hold on, take my hand. right here, gotta hold on.
Thanks to Carrie, Matt, and everyone else who called in. By the way, we want to hear what you think about what you hear on the show. Want to chime in? Think we're wrong? Want to just do something funny on our voicemail? Go for it. 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. If you don't have a pen handy, the number's on our website, soundcheck.org.
And now, Soundcheck looks back at the pop charts of yesteryear and asks...
That was a hit?
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
They're coming to take me away, haha.
Time for another installment of That Was a Hit, our series about improbable chart success, and we're joined again by Paul Ford, a Brooklyn-based writer who can be found on Twitter at FTrain. And he joins us with the saga of a song called Sukiyaki. Paul, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what is Sukiyaki?
So this was a...
I mean, I know what sukiyaki is, the Japanese hot pot dish, but what's the song?
Well, sort of that's a good point because the title has absolutely nothing to do with the song. It's 1963, and this pop hit in Japan gets sort of discovered and imported into the U.S. and then sort of spreads out throughout the entire world, and they call it sukiyaki. The actual title is... it's something like, I look up as I walk is how it translates. Uh-huh. And it's uye omuye te are oku.
And yeah, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't care how good a song it is. That ain't happening on American radio.
But what I love is that they were just like, screw it.
Let's just call
sukiyaki.
It sukiyaki.
Yeah, they just gave in. And because that's something people know.
Oh, my goodness.
And when you listen to it, it's a colossal earworm. Like you can
it
just.
It really is.
Yeah, and it's really sort of like, it's jaunty. The thing that's key about it is aside from the vocals, there's really nothing Japanese about this song. As it got sort of internalized, everyone started covering it. There were all these covers, and half of them would have like Kodo intros or just sort of this weird, they kept Japanesing up the music.
Let's hear the original version by Kiyu Sakamoto, which went to number one in this country, the only time a Japanese language song has been such a hit, Sukiyaki. Kiyu Sakamoto and the huge smash international hit Sukiyaki from 1963, the only time a Japanese language song has hit the American charts, and it topped the charts for a while.
It was colossal, just endless covers. I mean, when you listen to it, I listened to it a few times, it is burrowed into my brain like no other song in recent memory.
So how successful was this post-1963?
Well, that's the thing. This thing just got into the culture and held on. And it's almost, you know, it just sort of goes forever. If you start just Googling sukiyaki and doing some research, there's no end in sight. And, you know, there are dozens of covers just on, you know, say Spotify. Mm-hmm. And so it lodged in. There were a lot of covers in the 60s, kind of disappeared for a while. And then around 1981, Taste of Honey, who are sort of best known for, it's either Boogie Oogie or Oogie Oogie Boogie. I always get that mixed up. They were approached by kind of a song plugger in L.A. who was friends with the original composer. And he got them to record a cover of this, except this was another example of like they really Japanese'd it up.
And anglicized it at the same time. And
they wrote so one of the women in Taste of Honey actually wrote her own version of the lyrics, kind of I think working with some of the people originally involved with the song. And they're very, you know, she's like, well, it could have multiple meanings, you know, but what I went for was the romantic version.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear a little bit of Taste of Honey's version of Sukiyaki, which got as high as number 3 in 1981. That's just awful.
Yeah, I know. It's terrible. And it just gets worse and worse as it goes on. But nonetheless, that became just a monster hit. And it landed
number three on the Hot 100. Taste of Honey's version of Sukiyaki, English lyrics, but the Japanese koto, the traditional zither at the beginning of the song.
It's brutal.
Like, hey, this is Japanese.
Exactly. And so it's got that sort of uncomfortable, you know, 80s Japanese racism thing going that was really prevalent at the time. Everyone was wearing kimonos, and there was that real sort of pop.
Really?
Moment. Yeah, there's a little, if that's, as I was poking around.
I don't remember people wearing kimonos.
Oh, it's bad, because as I was poking around at the edges of this song, you know, the related artists and that sort of stuff, there's a lot of, like, you know, my Japanese boy and these sort of weird,
We're speaking with Paul Ford, the Brooklyn-based writer who occasionally joins us for our series, That Was a Hit, and we're talking about Sukiyaki, which was indeed a hit, not just here in the States, but around the world, comes back from 1963, comes back in 1981. You were telling me before we went on the air that it's on Mad Men?
Yeah, it showed up on...
So is it like the cicadas, where every 17 or 18 years this thing comes back?
That's exactly right. It just sort of... There is something so powerful about this song, and it just repeatedly gets weaponized and sort of shot back out into the pop charts.
Eventually, it makes its way into the world of hip-hop.
Well, and sort of through a circuitous route, there's a Dougie Fresh song called Lottie Dottie that is sort of one of the key tracks in hip-hop. And there's a point in the song, it's not on every version because they had clearance issues, where they sing a portion of this.
So it's not a sample. They're actually singing a bit of the melody.
No one could have afforded this much sampling back when they were doing it.
Right. When was this?
I think it's 85.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay. So this is Dougie Fresh and Slick Rick, and a little bit of Lottie Dottie with Sukiyaki embedded in it.
I ran through her. I bumped into my old girl from the
valley.
This is a girl plays hard to get, so I said, what's wrong? Because she looked upset. She said, it's all because of you. I'm feeling sad and blue. You went away, and now my life is filled with rainy days. And I love you so, how much you'll never know. Because you took your love away from me.
Slick Rick and Dougie Fresh with Lottie Dottie, incorporating a bit of the Japanese hit from 1963, Sukiyaki, the original song by Kyu Sakamoto, the subject of this installment of our occasional series, That Was a Hit. It is undeniably a song with staying power, Paul.
Well, you know, and the interesting thing, too, is not that part of the song, but... But the other sections of that were sampled, and I mean, they show up on it. Samples show up in DJ Premier, Das FX, The Roots, Color Me Bad. Like, everyone has sampled from that original tune. So at some
level, you mean from Lottie Dottie?
From Lottie Dottie. Yeah, sorry, yes. Yeah, yeah. So at some level, like, there's some weird genealogical thing going on where Sukiyaki is deeply embedded in a huge swath of hip hop, even if you can't hear it.
Yeah. And then, of course, there is that song, which just, you know, even in its original version, keeps coming back. The Mad Men scene is kind of odd.
Well, and Yeah, so it's set in 1962. It's season two, and one of the characters, his father, has died in a plane crash, and this is a big plot point. Don Draper is sitting in a what looks to be a Chinese restaurant, and Sukiyaki is playing in the background.
I have to drop this off, but I can swing back around on my way out.
Not tonight.
And since the whole show is about a plane crash, it's weird to have that playing because Kiyo Sakamoto actually died in one of the worst plane crashes in history, which was a Japan Airlines crash in 1985, killed well over 500 people. And so there's this strange plane crash resonance going on in that music cue. And given the way Mad Men is constructed, it's easy to imagine that they would have been playing with that.
Yeah. Paul Ford is a Brooklyn-based writer who joins us occasionally for our series, That Was a Hit, the strange and convoluted and ongoing tale of Sukiyaki. Paul, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Here's a Brazilian version from the trio Esperanza. Up next, the English electronic musician John Hopkins tells us how Brian Eno changed the way he approaches making music. And John Hopkins will make a little music in the studio, both acoustic and electronic, coming up next. This is Soundcheck.
Who've burst your bubble? And who drags you down, down?
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In the background, you're hearing a collaborative album between the pianist and electronic music composer John Hopkins and King Creosote, the Scottish singer-songwriter, real name Kenny Anderson. The album was called Diamond Mine, and it was one of my favorites in the year 2011. So naturally, I was pretty excited to hear that John Hopkins was readying a new solo album. It's called Immunity. It's just out, and it brings John Hopkins to our Soundcheck studio. He's going to play live for us in just a moment. John, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
So this new record represents kind of a shift from the sound we were just hearing, King Creosote collaboration. Is this, I don't know, how many different sides of John Hopkins are there musically?
Just the two, I think. There's the loud and the quiet. I kind of like to sum it up in that way. I love how peaceful Diamond Mine is, but after touring that for a year or two, I was just desperate to make some noise again. So this record is kind of that.
And when you say make some noise, I mean, you actually, a lot of your work over the years has kind of blurred the distinction between noise and sounds that we consider more conventionally musical, right?
Yeah. I mean, I like to just include anything I find that I think can help bring life to the electronic kind of landscape. So I quite often just incorporate sounds from outside the studio or from in the room, just hitting things or tapping things and making beats with whatever I find, mm-hmm. rather than relying too much on just the computer.
So Immunity, for example, opens with the sounds of you walking up to your studio door, unlocking it, opening it, walking in.
Yeah, it was quite complex to arrange all that. I had to, to go in, play the tune, and then walk out again, start recording, walk in, but...
People have looked at this album, Immunity, as a kind of epic night out, you know, the arc of a night spent at a club or a rave or something like that. Is that how you intended it?
That's kind of the inspiration behind the ordering of the tracks and how it builds. But the actual content of the songs is a more apocalyptic, slightly more serious sort of subject than that. But yeah, I love the idea of... the sort of emotional content of one of those crazy nights where, you know, the sort of the sadness when it ends. And, you know, I love that kind of feelings, which you could look at as superficial if you're just looking at it's just someone parting, but actually they're very profound if you're experiencing them.
That Sunday morning coming down feeling.
Yeah.
So what about this first piece you're going to play for us called Open Eye Signal? This is one of the most dance-oriented pieces on the record. This early in that evening?
Very, very much so. This is the sort of, getting into the zone sort of track. For me, it's quite a hypnotic piece. It's, tends to be quite long and just looping round an irregular length sequence, so your mind kind of drifts and it has a strange effect.
You want to play it for us?
Yes, I'll do that.
All right. John Hopkins, the English pianist and electronic music composer, is with us in the Soundcheck studio. The album, out now, is called Immunity, and from it, here's a song called Open Eye Signal. John Hopkins, live on Soundcheck. That is John Hopkins, the English electronic musician, live in the Soundcheck studio with Open Eye Signal, one of the more dance-oriented numbers from his latest record, which is called Immunity. And John will be performing later this summer at the end of August, August 31st, at MoMA's PS1 in Queens as part of the PS1 warm-up series. Again, that's August 31st. John's here with us in the Soundcheck studio today. So that really is a live performance, you know, which has been the knock on so much electronic music and dance music recently. You know, it's like hit a button and the piece plays itself. That was certainly not the case there.
You can do a lot now. I mean, the technology exists for you to do pretty much anything. I mean, I can't bring all the synths with me that I made the track on, but I can control where it goes and how it sounds, and, you know.
So that was recognizably the same piece that's on the record, but it was also quite different.
Well, yeah, I mean, so because I can't bring the synths, I have to record takes of me doing that at home and bring the audio, and then just kind of you can choose where you're going with that as a play.
So you're basically doing a live remix right there in front of an audience.
That's a good way of putting it, yeah. So it means you can respond to the crowd and, you know, build it as you feel it, I think.
The album's called Immunity. Immunity from what?
It's more the feeling of immunity that music can give you a bit. I mean, it's quite a simple idea, really, but the feeling I get when I was writing that track, I was just buzzing. I just had such an amazing time writing it. I got so deeply into the details of it. And, yeah, I just, like, nothing else mattered for that time. I was just completely in that zone. And the title track itself, Immunity, is particularly about the... just the warmth of, you know, the music can give you, and it's kind of quite a romantic track, and, you know,
it is kind of with the piano leading the way.
And,
you're actually going to play the piano next, which surprises me a little bit, because the last time we spoke, you told me this horrific story of being 17 and. Mm-hmm. You said accidentally winning a piano competition. And you had to perform with the Royal College of Music Orchestra. And you said it was the most single terrifying moment of your life.
Yes, and it remains that as well. And I haven't made that accident again. it sort of put me off that world, really. I kind of imagined that I might go down that route.
As a teenager, thinking the classical piano thing might be your road,
and then until that day, and then it was just such it just felt so elitist, and it didn't feel like the way. I mean, I had to perform wearing tails, you know. It just seemed a bit ridiculous, really. I think that music wasn't written to be listened to in such a stultifying way. It was the popular music of its time, so I just felt totally ill at ease with it, and I love to perform in situations where people actually respond in an excited way.
Mm-hmm. So, but that doesn't mean that you've given up on the piano entirely, obviously.
No.
It's the lead instrument on the title track, Immunity, but it's also almost the only instrument on the album version of the piece you're going to do for us. So this solo piano version is not too far removed from what people will get on the record, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's kind of, I mean, on the album, there's processed versions of the piano in the background, kind of which build the atmosphere behind it. But this is just the raw thing, really.
And you don't need to be wearing a tux or tails. Your T-shirt will be just fine. You want to play it for us?
Yes.
All right. John Hopkins, the English pianist, electronic musician, composer, collaborator with, among others, Brian Eno and Coldplay and King Creosote. His solo record is called Immunity, and here's a track from it, played live at our piano, called Abandon Window. A very different side of John Hopkins here in our soundcheck studio, alone at our piano with Abandon Window, which is also one of the tracks on his new record called Immunity, much of which is considerably more electronic, more dance-oriented, but this more ambient side has long been a part of what you do. With Brian Eno, apart from him, but what has he sort of been like for you as a maybe a musical mentor?
Pretty amazing, as you can imagine. It was a dream, really, to get involved with him when I was 23. Get involved is a strange way of putting it. You know what I mean? I just found, very...
Well, most people who work with him don't have, like, easy ways of defining how the relationship works.
Yeah. He just loosened up the whole music-making process for me, really. He just kind of injects fun and spontaneity and humor and ridiculousness into it. Because you can get... I mean, I was young and so bound up in trying to get everything just accurate, and he just makes you realize that it's supposed to be less like that and more about that sort of surrendering to it and really going for it and really enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. So that's his big secret.
Yeah.
Have some fun while you're doing
that's
it.
That's kind of it, as far as I could pick up, yeah.
Now, the more ambient side of your work has led to some film score material. Mm. You've worked with Kevin MacDonald on a number of occasions.
Yeah.
And then there's the video for Immunity, which is really, it's not like a video just for one song. It's more of a like a trailer for the whole record.
Mm.
And it features some really striking imagery. I understand you worked with a biochemist on this.
Yeah, amazing stuff. I really wanted a way to introduce the album, in particular the arc of the album and how it transforms through the different moods. And to get a visual for that was so difficult. But the typographer, Craig Ward, who I'd been working with on The Sleeve, had introduced me to this guy, Lyndon Gledhill, who's, as you say, a biochemist working as a photographer as kind of in his part-time, really, shooting through a microscope at 1,000 times magnification, quite mundane chemical reactions, things that are happening around us all the time, but just lit through a spectral filter and some LED lights, and I was just blown away by how beautiful they look, really.
And how well it fits your music.
Yeah, and I got involved in terms of... Because I don't see my tracks really as visual things. I can't really. For me, they're kind of like physical structures in my head, but I can't really go beyond that. So I need someone else to realize it. And I know what colors they're supposed to be, so I could kind of guide him in terms of color. But the rest, was kind of up to him.
So you do see color with certain musical keys and notes?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, each track has a strong color identity, and that's the thing that video really introduces.
Yeah. You can watch the video on our website, soundcheck.org. It is really quite extraordinary. It's like chemical reactions, crystals forming, and stuff like that, all set to the music of John Hopkins.
And I love how you can see that it isn't graphics. You can see that it isn't computer. You know, you've got no idea what you're looking at. You just know that it's something physical. And I'm always trying to make the music sound as physical as possible, so it just kind of connected, really.
There's a kind of a curious thing that becomes the percussion track for that song.
Yeah.
I can't figure out what you've captured there. What is that?
It's one of the pedals on my piano.
Really?
Yeah. So the left pedal is kind of broken over the years. I've had the same piano since I was about 8 years old. And every time the tuner comes, he offers to fix the pedal. But I love that creaking sound so much. So I thought I'd actually build a track around it instead of getting rid of it.
Oh, that's a great use of some found sound. John, it's been a pleasure having you here performing for us in the studio, both acoustic and electronic.
Great.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., head on over to soundcheck.org to hear what's happening live in our studio. We'll be taping a session with the Norwegian singer and songwriter Jarle Bernhoft. Just Bernhoff to you, became known here in the States via YouTube for his song Come On Talk. Tomorrow night at 9, author Michael Streisguth joins us to talk about his new book, Outlaw, Waylon, Willie, Chris, and the Renegades of Nashville. And the Latin pop band La Santa Cecilia talks about their ballad about undocumented immigrants called Ice El Hielo. And singer-songwriter Laura Stevenson plays songs from her new album, Wheel. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We'll let you know when we post new sessions recorded in the Soundcheck studio. That does it for tonight. See you tomorrow at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.